Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on beautiful children's Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
We have been told by his campaign that he has been preparing pretty intensively. He has been holding town hall style events for his campaign to practice.
They said Donald Trump is going to New Hampshire to practice for Sunday. This has nothing to do with Sunday. And it's like they make you into like a child. You really think that Hillary Clinton is debate prepping for 3 or 4 days? Hillary Clinton is resting, okay? She's resting. She wants to build up her energy for Sunday night. And you know what? That's fine. But the narrative is so foolish.
That's Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Robbie Mook, and GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump talking about Sunday night's debate here in St. Louis. There is preparation to be done no matter what. Someone's going to at least want to kind of talk over how you go about debating your opponent there on national television. Of course, with the other things in the news, like a hurricane on the East Coast and the Caribbean and the baseball playoffs, fewer people might be paying attention. Who benefits most from the media distraction from the presidential debate? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. Live this Friday afternoon, October the 7th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to get a little bit on the vice presidential debate, a little bit on the presidential debate, and a general update on the November elections with Mark and Molly Hemingway of the Weekly Standard and the Federalist here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. A little bit later in the program, we're going to talk about that new survey on the beliefs of American evangelicals. It seems American evangelicals have a peculiar view of Scripture alone that leads them to, well, in some cases, perhaps what we could call unintentional heresy. Deaconess Rose Adel will join us. We'll talk about motherhood regret. There is a column inside the growing movement of women who wish they'd never had kids. We'll get her reaction to that. Then we'll play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week in the last half hour of the program. We will play our four soundbites, and then you give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email with your vote, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet @IssuesETC, or vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/IssuesETC, facebook.com/IssuesETC. Issues Etc. soundbite of the week in the last half hour of the program. Joining us for our weekly update on the November elections, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
And Molly Hemingway, senior editor for the Federalist. Molly, welcome.
Great to be here with you.
You have been recently speaking on the subject of religious liberty, Molly, and the people to whom this matters. What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, I've recently been at Westminster Theological Seminary, which is reformed in Philadelphia, and they're holding an ecumenical conference where people are speaking on a variety of topics about faith in public square in general. And so there are a variety of opinions on the situation as regards religious liberty and being able to be Christian in public life. And the thing that's most interesting about this conference, I actually speak to a lot of different people on this topic in general. What I'm really intrigued by here is, so the first conference that I've attended where everybody seems to immediately be aware of how dire the situation is or how serious the situation is, what persecution the church is facing and what persecution her people are facing and how it's different than what they maybe thought persecution would look like in terms of actual physical martyrdom. This is more a martyrdom of reputation or, about losing a job or just having a difficult way in a country that you thought had been friendlier to your religious views than it's turning out to be. And of course, there's also a lot of discussion about how to handle oneself in political life, and this being a challenging election in particular. And you're seeing a variety of viewpoints. You have people who've come out rather strongly against Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. You have people who don't particularly like either candidate but are willing to vote for Donald Trump because they think he will be less hostile to religious expression than Hillary Clinton, and that he has a chance of appointing people at the federal level in the judiciary and in the executive branch who might be less hostile to religious expression than Hillary Clinton's appointees almost certainly would be.
We spoke with Mark earlier this week after the vice presidential debate. We didn't have an opportunity to hear from you on it. What's your takeaway from the vice presidential debate, Molly?
You know, I know people say that vice presidential debates aren't very important and that people don't make decisions on who to vote for president based on the vice presidential debate. At the same time, I had, and maybe because I had low expectations, I thought it turned out to be an extremely interesting debate. Tim Kaine, the Democratic candidate, took the more traditional role of attack dog. He did what you normally expect people to do, which is constantly remind voters of what they don't like about the opposing party's top of the ticket. In the case of Mike Pence, he stayed extremely unflappable. He was very calm, measured, and very hyper-focused on his message, which I think the thing that was most interesting about his role in that debate, that he gave voice to those people who actually don't agree with Donald Trump very much or don't even like him very much but are still voting for him. I think Mike Pence embodied that type of voter, of which, if you know people who support Trump, he reminded me of a lot of the people I know who support Trump. They tend to be conservative. They tend to care about ideology, and they don't have any delusions about Donald Trump being a particularly principled or moral man. But they still are supporting him for president because they think it will be the less bad option, or possibly even a good option.
Let's talk about the one that's coming up Sunday here in the St. Louis area. Mark, what are your expectations for the second presidential debate? What does Secretary Clinton have to do? What does Donald Trump have to do?
Well, you might recall, it wasn't a straight-up town hall debate like this is going to be, but back in early September, we had that Matt Lauer Forum on National Security that was a town hall format where Hillary Clinton spoke and then Donald Trump spoke. And they gave us, I think, some indication of what this next town hall forum debate was, you know, could possibly be like. Hillary Clinton did quite poorly in that debate. Lauer asked her a bunch of specific questions about her emails, something that the moderator didn't really press her on that much in the first debate. And she fumbled the answers. And then just in general, Hillary Clinton is a terrible retail campaigner in the sense that she's very bad at talking to the normals. I mean, she's not a person that comes off very naturally. She's basically the complete opposite of her husband. And so this is a format where she's going to have to address specific people in the audience. And she's really going to have to, like, find a way that she, you know, comes off as something that she hasn't thus far in the campaign, you know, both on the campaign trail and in that last forum I discussed. So it'll be very curious to see how she approaches sort of softening who she is and coming across as more gregarious and warm, especially since there are probably going to be some hostile questions. As for Trump, well, obviously he did very poorly in the last debate. Polls plummeted after the last debate. And he's got to find a way to, not be defensive, as he is very characteristically is about his business record and about his private life and about all of the crazy things that he's said over the years. And it's one thing to be defensive when Hillary Clinton is lobbing the charges at you or even moderators asking pointed questions. But if a, you know, normal person is stepping up to the plate in front of a microphone in a town hall debate and asking very pointed questions about, you know, comments he's made about women or other things, Trump has got to find a way to respond to those answers in a way that shows that he's humane, compassionate, and actually cares about people and, you know, maybe even, God forbid, regrets some of the stuff that he said. But that is very uncharacteristic of Trump, and there haven't been a lot of issues or statements in this campaign that he has, you know, backed away from or things that he's done in his past. So it'll be very interesting to see how he moderates himself, if at all, in this debate.
Same question for you, Molly.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how things go. I think that Hillary Clinton did pretty well at the last debate and Donald Trump did less well. I actually don't think it was quite as extreme as the after-action reports made it seem like, and also that Donald Trump himself had a really bad week and kind of flailed out of control after the last debate, which made it seem like he did worse in the debate. But in a way, the fact that everybody thinks he did poorly relative to Hillary Clinton helps him out now, because expectations could not be lower for him. The way that we have kind of remembered what happened in that first debate, it's as if he was drooling on stage. He actually wasn't that bad. Hillary Clinton wasn't nearly as good as her friends in the mainstream media like to pretend she was. But now she's being treated as if she should be ahead by 50 points. So the expectations are very high for her. I think even with those expectation games going into this, I think it'll probably be probably more of a draw. And I think Donald Trump needs a real clear victory. Hillary Clinton does not need a victory in a debate at this point. But if she were to stumble, that would really change things. And if Donald Trump could pull off a really decisive counterpunch, that would be huge for him. I just want to point out, he does a better job than she does of actually articulating the case for his candidacy. He stays usually, this last debate being an exception, he usually stays focused on the themes of his campaign about American strength and about the need to reject tired old ways of doing things. And Hillary Clinton doesn't really have a very coherent message for her campaign other than that she is not Donald Trump, which is compelling in its own way. So I think he has an advantage there in that he can keep pushing the issues that people actually care about in this race.
What, Molly, what you said, a clear victory or a counterpunch on Trump's part, what in particular, give us an example, what would that look like for it to actually benefit him?
Well, I think that he should, if he could, really remind people of why he came to have such strength of position in the first place. I mean, it's a very improbable story about how such a man like himself could win the Republican nomination and still be keeping it close in this race. And if he could remind people, just calmly remind people of all of Hillary Clinton's corruption problems from her foundation, from the way that the foundation operated as a way to keep friends close, to make financial benefits for herself and her friends by using her ties to power, about the way that she mishandled classified information in a way that put our country at risk and continues to put our country at risk, about her foreign policy decision-making of invading countries and destabilizing regimes that allowed for the growth of ISIS. These are points he made during the primary when he was running against Republicans, because sometimes Republicans either were too soft on these things or complicit. He did a good job in the debates of being very nimble and remembering to achieve that type of message, speaking directly to the people. He continues to be all right on it, but not as good as we saw it in the primary debate.
I think it's also true that, well, we talk a lot about Donald Trump being very bad when he gets defensive about his own record and the things that he's done. It hasn't been commented on as much that Hillary Clinton is absolutely terrible when she's under attack, too. Again, in that forum with Matt Lauer, she asked specifically about her email stuff. I mean, she was absolutely terrible. She often doubles down on previous lies. And on top of that, you know, to the extent that she has acknowledged things wrong, she gets almost angry that she has to concede again that she made some sort of mistake, even though she's failed to explain so many facets of the particular email scandal, the problems with her foundation, and all manner of other things that she's been involved in. And as we saw in the vice presidential debate, Pence was very good at, you know, despite the fact that, you know, he was under attack as well, making sure that he always turned around and brought the fight back to Tim Kaine and made Tim Kaine defend Hillary Clinton's, you know, national security record on ISIS and Iran, and, you know, brought up the emails and other things like that. And, you know, the truth is, well, Donald Trump can't defend his scandals and statements, you know, neither can Hillary Clinton. So a lot about winning the debate, at least on points, is going to be who can stay on the attack the most and who can be defensive the least.
Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. We're getting our weekly update on the November elections when we come back. If the subject of Trump's tax returns comes up in Sunday's debate, what should his response be?
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The the best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Zion Lutheran, Muscoda, Illinois. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Grace Lutheran, Auburn, Michigan. Zion Lutheran, Pleasant Plains, Illinois. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word, Rochester Hills, Michigan. Zion Lutheran, Laramie, Wyoming. Redeemer Lutheran, Seymour, Indiana. Zion Lutheran, East Moline, Illinois. And Peace Lutheran, South St. Louis County. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're getting our weekly update on the November elections with Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard and Molly Hemingway of the Federalist. Mark, back to the debate coming up Sunday. How likely do you think it is that Hillary Clinton will raise the subject yet again of Donald Trump's personal income tax returns? And if so, how should he respond?
Well, I'm sure she will, but this is sort of a very sort of curious thing, which is that there's no crime here. I mean, you know, Trump had a very bad year and then made, you know, took tremendous losses in his business, nearly $1 billion. And as such, you know, he didn't pay taxes. And through, you know, these carry forward part of the tax code, you know, it's possible that for years afterward he didn't pay taxes. I mean, this is something that is, you know, perfectly permissible under the tax code. So the question is whether or not, how much American voters really care about this. Now, this was sort of an issue when Mitt Romney was running for president, because there was, you know, some specific tax loopholes that he used as, you know, a successful private equity guy the Democrats got really upset about. But of course, Democrats didn't mind these specific loopholes as long as the guys that were taking advantage of them were also turning around writing checks to Democrats. And only when these issues with the tax code become politicized do they even pretend to care. I mean, the reality is we need a major tax code overhaul on this particular issue. And with Trump in particular, It you know, he could turn right around and he can make all sorts of, you know, points about how Hillary Clinton's, you know, tax problems over the years have been an issue. I mean, the reason why we know about the fact that she made $100,000 profit on that politically connected cattle futures deal back in the day was in her tax return. And when Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992, he disclosed every tax return up until the year that showed up on the tax return. So it's not like Hillary Clinton is some sort of innocent when it comes to this sort of thing. And the reality is that, you know, there's no political will to change the tax code, and Trump's been the guy out there saying the system is rigged, the tax code's rigged, and I know because I've been taking advantage of it. It's part of his brand at this point in time.
Molly, the issue of emails seems somewhat tired, but it is the Hillary Clinton version of the Donald Trump tax issue, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and the idea that it's tiresome is part of the problem with the Clinton operating style. I did endure that first Clinton presidency, which was one thing in terms of its policy, entirely another in how tiresome it was to follow the scandals. The Clintons have this approach of withholding the release of information and fighting and claiming that you're crazy if you think that they did this or that. And then 6 months later, you realize that they're even admitting that they did this or that. And just today, you know, the State Department is preparing to release the first batch of those deleted emails that they've been able to recover. I mean, there have been batches after batches after batches of emails that get released that shed new light on corruption and problems. I mean, just recently we learned that the White House had actually worked with Clinton and the State Department to obstruct coverage of the story of her emails. I mean, that's a pretty scandalous thing that if we had a halfway decent media, they would be all over. Or I should say, if this were a Republican administration, it would be leading the news every night. And so it is tiresome, but I think that in a way it speaks to issues that are much more concerned to people. I mean, the email server was her attempt to obstruct oversight of her operations, to enable her to continue Clinton Foundation operations. And in so doing, this thing that benefited her personally, there was a risk to national security. I don't particularly like that Donald Trump hasn't released his taxes, and I'd like to know if there are conflicts of interest in his investments and whatnot. But when it comes to the two scandals, I don't really think they're similar. I think compromising national security is actually much more important than how much money a sort of con man business guy is making in this, that, or the other.
I do want to ask you one media-related question here, Molly, before we move on to some of those particulars we've already touched upon, and that is, we've got a hurricane moving up the East Coast. It's already made its way through the Caribbean. That's kind of wiping headlines for during its tenure there. Also, the baseball playoffs are underway in a weekend, things like that. Does that distraction, those distractions that are serious as frivolous as they may be, which candidate do they benefit more by not having them in the news?
I've had this theory for a while that whichever candidate is being talked about suffers. Whichever one you're talking about, you're usually talking about their various scandals or problems or errors of judgment. So usually when the media are spending time talking about someone, it's bad for the person that they're talking about. And so you've noticed that the media had a few weeks where they just were forced into covering Hillary Clinton and her lies because she publicly fell down at the 9/11 memorial, but they quickly got back off of her and back onto Donald Trump. So I think in general it would help him, since they seem to be much more frenzied about him than they are her by a factor of about a million. And I'll be curious to see. They also, though, there is corollary to this, which is each increasing outrage they have about only one of the candidates renders media coverage something that you tend to tune out more and more and more. So the more you hear the media freak out about something Donald Trump say, and the more you realize that it's maybe not even a trustworthy analysis. Just by way of example, last night the Washington Post misquoted Donald Trump to make it sound like he was referring to immigrants as poison. He was actually referring to heroin that crosses the border as poison. So, you know, if you get all whipped up into a frenzy about a story like that and then you realize that the media were completely making up their version of events, it makes you less likely to believe them in the future. But again, in general, it helps Trump to not be in the news.
I would also just point out for this sort of specific news cycle here, there have been a lot of Hillary Clinton emails released both yesterday in terms of the White House coordination stuff that was a big story, and there are more emails dropping today. So I don't know whether that's just coincidental or what, but certainly having a big hurricane, you know, in the headlines or whatever is beneficial to Hillary in the sense that there's something else going on in the news, you know, on a long 3-day weekend that is distracting people from otherwise paying attention to a couple of stories that would be very bad for Clinton. And as for the particular hurricane issue, I would point out that there was a story in the past couple of days that the Clinton campaign had took out a huge ad buy on the Weather Channel to make sure that people saw Clinton ads, then they weren't, you know, their campaign wasn't wiped off the map. And they backed away from that ad buy after people kind of pointed out that it was sort of inappropriate and ghoulish.
Mark, you have written about Department of Justice and FBI documents and the deals that were apparently struck, side agreements, you say, with Clinton aides in terms of immunity. What have you found?
Yeah, well, there was the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee admitted that not only did they grant immunity to certain Clinton aides as part of the deals, they struck these side agreements that they were called, where they agreed to not look at any documents on the computers of these Clinton aides that after a certain date, I think it was like January 15, 2015, and this was, you know, about 5 weeks before some of the most serious allegations of obstruction of justice were alleged to have occurred. And on top of that, the FBI promised under the terms of the agreement to destroy the computers after they were done searching them. You know, and this is, again, just, it's been baffling all along. Like, why did they have to give these Clinton aides immunity deals? They didn't. These computers were physical evidence. Standard operating procedure would be you simply subpoena it, and you take it, and you have it for however long as you possibly need it, and there's not a darn thing that the people can do about it. But somehow, not only did we get these insane immunity deals that nobody can explain why they were handed out, we get a situation here where they're destroying the physical evidence that could be used to, you know, indict somebody. I mean, it's madness.
And is there, I know, indignation on the part of many people about this, but the pile is so large now. And as Molly just pointed out, Mark, the story is so complicated now. Does the average person simply say, more of the same, and tune out?
Well, I think that there's definitely an element of that, but you have to remember that this is a specific strategy, as Molly pointed out, that Clinton's pioneered in the 1990s, and they would drag these scandals out. I mean, you know, they were finding documents, you know, in bedrooms in the White House months later or whatever that they were supposed to cough up immediately. I mean, they would just deliberately make everything, you know, take as long as they possibly could for, you know, to emerge. And then by the time all of the key evidence is coming out, they're saying, oh, you know, you had, you know, press secretaries, you know, openly saying, well, this is an old story. Nobody cares about it anymore, as if that were relevant to, you know, what was actually going on. But the fact of the matter is they know darn good and well in political terms that, you know, voter indignation and voter interest in these sorts of things is often what drives media coverage of it, which, you know, dictates political consequences. And that also alleviates the political pressure to do something about it. So this is a deliberate strategy on their part. And, you know, it's worked so far. I mean, Comey did not charge Hillary Clinton with any crime. And, I mean, I don't think any objective observer can look at what Hillary Clinton did and say she didn't break any laws. I mean, it's total insanity, and it's kind of depressing, frankly.
What I've wondered about this, Molly, is this is a story that obviously is continuing far longer than anyone in the Clinton camp thought it would or wants it to. Does it follow her if she's elected? Does it follow her into the White House, or is election going to be portrayed as vindication?
Interesting question, and I think that the Hillary camp keeps on having a wishful thought that it will be over, or that it will be over should she be elected. I see no reason to believe that it would be over if she were elected because of the issues, because of the seriousness of the issues involved. I mean, you can remember that Richard Nixon was impeached after he was elected for the second term for things that happened during his first term. And so the fact that she is moving from one office to another should not really have much sway on whether or not she is ultimately held accountable. I mean, the more we learn about how incapable our highly politicized Department of Justice and FBI are to hold their friends accountable, I mean, I think that if the members of Congress are worth anything at all, they have to start thinking seriously about the preservation of the republic and what happens when people lose faith in institutions to hold people accountable. This is not just about Hillary Clinton, but this is perhaps the greatest example of the problems that are caused by a highly politicized executive branch that serves only those people who are elite with access to power.
I think it's true that the ordinary American isn't following every twist and turn of this and may even be sick of the scandal to some extent. But I also think it's true that, you know, you see polls that show that, again, these are far and away the two most unpopular presidential candidates in modern history, and they're running against each other. I mean, I think the majority of Americans decided early on that, you know, this Clinton scandal, you know, looked bad, it smells bad, it is bad, and they know darn good and well that the Clintons are getting away with something because they're politically connected. If Hillary Clinton does win, I think that a large majority of Americans, even a large percentage of people that voted for Clinton, will have understood that this happened only because that people judged the other guy was worse, not because Hillary Clinton was in any way, shape, or form a legitimate or good candidate that people liked. I mean, I think she's going to be walking into office tremendously unpopular and, you know, frankly, illegitimate in a lot of ways in the voters' eyes. And if she starts, you know, her term early on with, you know, being significantly unpopular, it's going to be very hard for her to do anything. Congress isn't going to want to cooperate. And I think you might even see before long, you know, Democrats breaking with her on certain issues, especially if she tries to push an ambitious agenda of things like the public option, you know, which is this nationalized health insurance scheme that she wants and all kinds of other things. I just don't see where she goes from here. I mean, you know, the Clintons tend to find a way, so I'm not ruling anything out. But her chances of being, you know, a big, bold, successful president right from the get-go are pretty low.
On the other side of the break, we're going to be talking more about the presidential debate, the November elections. Molly Hemingway of The Federalist is our guest, along with Mark Hemingway of Weekly Standard. And on the other side, we'll talk about Miss Universe and Donald Trump. Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in October, and we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand t-shirt. Find out more about our monthly or annual giving program at issuesetc.org. Just click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, or call Craig 618-223-8385. Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by Reformation Day, and we'll send you a limited edition long sleeve shirt along with your other membership benefits.
The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Yes, there is a Messiah in Seattle. Messiah Lutheran Church and Concordia Lutheran School have served North Seattle for over 60 years, and we invite you to join us on Sunday mornings at 8 and 10:45 with Bible study at 9:20. Messiah Seattle is proud to support Issues Etc. To learn more, watch our adult information class videos online or on DVD. Our website is messiahseattle.org, 206-524-0024.
When pastors talk about us, they call us ad crucem. When laity mention us, they speak of ad crucem. When non-Lutherans address us, they say ADC RUCAM. But no matter how you say it, ad crucem is the place to go for greeting cards, artwork, jewelry, ornaments, housewares, church certificates, church banners, and all your gift-buying needs. Visit adcrucem.com, confessing the faith through art and word. ADCRUCEM.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office. 314-416-8117.
Are you looking for Christmas cards that combine beautiful art with a clear Christian confession? Emmanuel Press offers Christ-centered, affordable cards in a variety of designs. You'll find cards with stained glass, illumination, German frescoes, and other unique artwork found only at Emmanuel Press. Visit their website, emmanuelpress.us, E-M-M-A-N-U-E-L, press.us.
What's so ironic about this is that in their zeal to try to elevate the gospel and talk about a second use of the gospel, they're actually diminishing the gospel, because a second use of the gospel is by definition law.
The discerning consumer of this type of television should say, Rod Parsley is offering these blessings, Larry Huck is offering these blessings, I think I want those ones better than those ones, so I'll send my money to that guy.
With modern bromances or modern friendships or even modern marriages, the moment it's not fun anymore, you're not happy anymore, you just abandon it. You leave it because it's not serving you.
Tradition is smarter than any one of us, smarter than any group of us, smarter than any generation.
1 hour from now, we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. A little taste there. We have a soundbite from Dr. Joel Bierman, How the Gospel is Turned into Law. Soundbite number 2, Pastor Chris Rosebro, Shopping the Televangelist. Soundbite number 3, Pastor Chris Hull on Suffering and Christian Camaraderie. And soundbite number 4, Dr. Christian Koff, Tradition and Objective Truth. Coming up in 1 hour, you'll get to pick one of those to be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. In the meantime, our weekly update on the November elections with Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard and Molly Hemingway of the Federalist. Molly, who is Alicia Machado, and why do you say that she is 2016's Sandra Fluke?
Well, this from the last debate, when Hillary Clinton kind of rushed at the end to get in a story about a Miss Universe who she said Donald Trump had treated very poorly. And so she kind of ambushed him with this story of a Miss Universe who Donald Trump had supposedly been rude to, which of course is not hard to believe if we know anything about Donald Trump. Well, the next day, the New York Times had a double byline story about this woman, and Cosmopolitan and The Guardian had photo spreads ready to go. And these were stories that were embargoed. They were put together with help from the Clinton campaign, and they were embargoed until such time as Hillary Clinton mentioned her name. And so I thought, you know, it is an interesting story, but the way that the media handled it was a little bit too much in cahoots with the Clinton campaign. And it turned out that the story that journalists, real journalists, should have been much more skeptical of Hillary Clinton's version of events. This was a woman who, so Donald Trump used to be involved with the Miss Universe pageant, and this woman had won Miss Universe, and then she had packed on, according to CNN, nearly 60 pounds during her reign. A lot of people thought she should be fired because she had violated the terms of her contract. Donald Trump said, no, we're just going to help her get her weight down through diet and exercise. And then it turned out further that not only was that part of the story not how Hillary Clinton had portrayed it, but that Alicia Machado turned out not to be the best spokesperson for the Clinton campaign. She was accused by a judge of threatening to kill him because he had put her fiancé in jail for killing someone. She had allegedly driven the getaway car during that murder. She also had a baby with a Mexican drug lord and became a U.S. citizen a couple months ago. So journalists, I mean, and that's all, you know, we all have our complicated history, but journalists shouldn't have been so eager to take this story as just purely good news for Hillary Clinton, when in fact the story also kind of helped out Donald Trump. His big narrative is that we don't do a good job of vetting immigrants, that we have, in the case of Mexico, sometimes there are people coming from Mexico who are not excellent citizens and whatnot. And so if the media had been more impartial and less insane in how they covered this, I think it would have been better. And it's just a good lesson to not carry a candidate's water, but to be dispassionate journalists who skeptically look at any story.
Speaking of immigration that touches upon that, one of the things that has been kind of dogging the Trump campaign is Trump's statements about Muslims and immigration. And Mike Pence put some distance, if not as much as he could, between himself and the head of the ticket on that recently, didn't he, Molly?
Well, I think that this is a great example, the story of Donald Trump's position on Muslims entering the country is a great example of what one journalist said is how the media take Donald Trump literally, but not seriously, and his supporters take him seriously, but not literally. So when he proposes something that just sounds very, you know, extreme, like a complete shutdown on Muslims entering the United States, it gets people talking about whether you can have an immigration policy geared towards certain goals and what those goals should be. And so Mike Pence, I don't think he's disavowing it so much as just being kind of a sensible person in the middle of the media and Donald Trump, who both can be so extreme in their own way of talking about issues. And it's, you know, people call it the moving of the Overton window when you say something extreme to just get people kind of thinking in a different way. It's kind of a function that Donald Trump fulfills. And Mike Pence is actually a competent, sane human being who can translate that into policies that might be more appealing to a broader swath of people. And I think people are interested in making sure that our immigration policy isn't about this, like, whoever wants to come, come here, but an idea about how to protect the rights and interests of our near neighbors, those people who are in the United States with us currently, and with our responsibilities to people seeking a better life who live outside our borders. That's actually a pretty moderate position, and I think Mike Pence is just saying that's how he wants the conversation to move forward.
We were recently talking with a guest, and she was rather clever. We were talking about issues related to the presidential campaign and the election, and when it comes to life and abortion in the Supreme Court. And she said, it was Wendy Wright, formerly of Concerned Women for America. And she said, you know, given the Supreme Court prospects of both of these candidates, she has no problem voting for Mike Pence. She didn't say Donald Trump. She said Mike Pence. What do you make of that, Mark?
Well, I think a lot of people are looking for some sort of, you know, silver lining here, in that they are very alarmed about Clinton and her overall philosophy and all of the ramifications that a presidency under her would have. As disastrous as Donald Trump seems in some ways, the one thing about Donald Trump is that he does seem very uninterested and undisciplined in the more serious, when it comes to the more serious aspects of politics. So I think people looking for a reason to vote for Trump are looking at Mike Pence. They're looking at Newt Gingrich and other more sober and experienced political supporters of Trump, and hoping that these guys are going to play an outsized role in a Trump presidency. And I think it's, frankly, not a crazy thing to pin your hopes on. But at the end of the day, it's very hard to say, you know, Donald Trump is the guy at the top ticket, you know, what sort of influence he can exert as president and what he will choose, you know, to exert. exerted influence on. And on the other side of the spectrum there, I mean, I think that the way that George W. Bush's presidency collapsed did a lot of damage to values that I think a lot of conservatives held dear. And I think that there's also a concern that having a bad Republican president for 4 or 8 years, one that's truly bad, could do more long-term damage than, you know, having to suffer through an unpopular Democratic president. But, you know, if people think that Pence, they're putting their hopes on Pence, it's not the craziest thing I've heard this year, for sure.
Molly, before we let you guys go, paint a picture for us. What does a presidential debate night look like in the Hemingway house?
Oh, I mean, we have pretty modest lives, so we do try and actually watch the debate, and we do it together. We have some friends who don't have television. Sometimes they come over and watch with us, and they give us funny lines that we tweet out. Or my husband is pretty much the funniest person out there and is cracking jokes throughout the entire debate. But it's just fun to watch together in community and have a reaction. And one thing that Mark and I have noticed is that we tend to have different reactions than a lot of people in the media do. And so it's nice to have a platform to get those reactions out and just respond. But yeah, pretty standard, just watch and tweet.
So it's PJs, popcorn, and cuddling on the couch while tweeting at the same time? Is that the picture I'm getting?
Right, and I usually pour myself a nice tall glass of hemlock. It's a fun time.
Stay informed by reading Mark and Molly Hemingway's columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks again, guys.
And Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, thank you.
Thank you.
Another great resource for this election season is our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October called Called to Vote by Dr. Ken Sherbet's Christian's Approach to Elections, the basics on Christian citizenship, on a biblical understanding of our particular context here in the United States as ruler citizens, and what the Two Kingdoms doctrine of the Lutheran Reformation has to do with all of that. You can find out more about Called to Vote at our website on every page, issuesetc.org. It's downloadable and it's designed for your Bible class. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October called Called to Vote by Dr. Ken Sherb. On the other side of the break, Matthew Block joins us. We're going to talk about a new survey on the beliefs of American evangelicals, the heresy there, and in particular, the evangelical misperception of Scripture alone. Stay tuned. Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us. Doxology.us.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October is a timely, downloadable resource designed for Bible classes. It's titled Called to Vote, A Christian's Approach to Elections. Called to Vote is written by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Ken Sherb. You can find out more and download Called to Vote on every page of our website, issuesetc.org. Called to Vote, A Christian's Approach to Elections, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, issuesetc.org.